There's the big board, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Pennsylvania. We just got new metrics in.
Right now, a historic moment. We can now project the winner of the presidential race.
The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
The president-elect of the United States of America, Donald Trump.
Donald J. Trump is the president of the United States elect.
This is a political upset of huge, huge magnitude.
The country still divided.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi and welcome, listeners of the 45th podcast. I'm back this week with my colleague Susan Simpson. Hi, Susan. How are you doing?
Hey.
Surviving the heat wave?
Yes, barely.
Well, it's been pretty hot up on Capitol Hill. I know the last week has been full of a lot of news, and we have a fantastic guest this week who's going to help us unpack not just the Sessions hearing, but so much of our Attorney General's work. So I'm really excited to have our guest, Mr. Ames Grawert, to join us today on the 45th. And let me tell you a little bit about his background, and then we'll start a conversation with him. Ames is counsel at the Brennan Center's Justice Program, and he's also the John L. New Justice Council. His work at the Brennan Center is to develop an understanding of the cost of America's criminal justice system to all of us, the entire nation, defendants, inmates, and also to translate that information into legal change. Before joining the Brennan Center, he was the assistant DA at the Appeals Bureau of the Nassau County DA's office, where he reviewed and litigated claims of actual innocence in addition to his appellate work, which is of particular interest to me.
yeah, at some point, I'd love to hear more about your work when you were doing actual innocence and commission integrity in it.
Yeah, I'd love to.
In fact, listening to Serial at the, or when I was at that job, it was a little bit like continuing to work on the way home.
Were you at the DA's office when you were listening to Serial?
Yep.
Fantastic. Well,
before
public service, though, you were in private practice, right, at Mayer Brown LLP. And so you have a really lengthy career in criminal justice, working both on the defense and prosecutorial sides. So welcome, and I'm excited to have you here today. Can you tell us a little bit about your work to begin with at the Brennan Center?
Sure. First of all, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for taking the time to speak with me. So the Brennan Center is a really interesting group. It's billed very often as a think tank, but that's just sort of part of the picture. We start with research for sure. We start with a quantitative perspective on a lot of our issues, from voting rights to criminal justice reform to liberty and national security. But we have a very strong communications team where they're very successful at helping us refine our message to, you know, convince the public of the importance of these issues. And very rarely, but some of my colleagues more than others, we take that issue to the courts. And on other occasions, we try to lobby Congress to pass affirmative change that will advance our issues.
So Ames, in a hypothetical world where Hillary Clinton won the election, what do you think your group will be focusing on right now?
I actually don't have to be hypothetical about that, candidly. We had a very good idea of what that would look like. I think it would have been pretty exciting. And some of its work, I know we're going to be picking up later on. So when I started here, I was kind of surprised by the degree to which criminal justice reform, the movement to end mass incarceration, was truly bipartisan. It's something that you could get most Republicans, with a few noted exceptions, one of whom is now Attorney General, to believe in the importance of rethinking who we incarcerate and why, and right, coming up with a better way to approach crime and punishment in the United States. So our goal was, or the idea that we had, was in a theoretical Clinton White House or the Purple Congress, we were hoping we could leverage that and say, look, this was a very bruising election. We need to come together around something that President Clinton has talked about as a real priority for her. In fact, one of her, I think it was her very first speech as a candidate, was about criminal justice reform and mass incarceration. So we wanted to pitch it as an issue that would bind the country back together on a shared list of priorities. I think it was a surprise to all of us that the election turned out much differently than any of us expected. But we're starting to find our footing, and hopefully we're going to have an approach like that where we're actually advocating for affirmative change in Washington sometime in the near future.
And not just fighting back against the current backsliding.
Exactly. Yeah, a lot of the work lately, and if you follow us on Twitter, which I highly recommend, then you'll see a lot of the work lately has been documenting everything that the Justice Department has done to start to dismantle that broad bipartisan consensus. I don't want to spoil the fun of reading it yourself, but it's quite a bit. There's a lot of progress that was made during the Obama administration under Attorney Generals Holder and Lynch, but especially Attorney General Holder was a great leader on this issue. But a lot of it wasn't in law. It was all in, you know, charging directives and policy memos about how the Department of Justice chose to use its resources. And a lot of that can be undone with a snap of the fingers. And the Attorney General currently has already started to do that. There's been a temptation, and I can get more into this later, I think, for those of us who work on criminal justice to give up on D.C. and say, you know, we've lost. We need to come back to this under a future presidency, but we need to pivot to the states where there a lot of change can be done. But we think that unless you have maybe not progress at the federal level, but unless you have, you know, someone working at the federal level to keep us from, you know, a true backslide to 1990s era tough on crime policies, which we know didn't work, then it gets much harder even at the state and local level. So we've been trying to make the case for federal reform still.
It's time now to check in with one of our great sponsors, Away, where you get first-class luggage at a coach price. Away is a team of thinkers, seekers, and designers, and their focus and inspiration is movement, times of transition, exploration, and surprise. So what they do is create special objects that are at home, on the road, that you carry forward, that make your trip easier, and in a small way, your life better. Away creates their luggage inspired by true travel stories. They ask thousands of people how they pack, why they travel, what bugs them most about their luggage, and then they designed a bag that solved a few old problems like sticky wheels and a few new ones too, like dead cell phones. So I own a piece of Away luggage. It is the go-to carry-on piece that I take when I travel. I travel all the time for different speaking engagements, and I can't tell you how much I love the design because it's made of this German polycarbonate material that is incredibly lightweight, very impact resistant. The inside is designed just beautifully. You can overpack stuff. It's got this compression system that helps it all come together. And believe me, I've been that person who's been stuck because of weather delays and stuff at airports for hours where I can't find a single outlet because hundreds of others are using those outlets, but I can just plug my phone right into my Away luggage and I'm good to go. But don't take my word for how amazing this luggage is. You have to check it out yourself. We have a special offer for our listeners. You get $20 off a suitcase, any size of your choosing, by visiting awaytravel.com/45 and using the promo code 45 during checkout. Again, you're going to get $20 off any suitcase of your choice by visiting awaytravel.com/45. And don't forget to use the promo code 45 during checkout. The offer won't last forever, so get your Away luggage today.
I just wonder sometimes what Sessions' goal is here. Like, what does he think the maximum theoretical incarceration rate is? And is he trying to hit that?
Right. So this is actually, I thought this was very disturbing. It's one of the first things he did when he became Attorney General was he repealed an order by Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates, which would have phased out the Bureau of Prisons, and that's the prison system at the federal level, would have phased out their use of private prisons. It would have taken a very long time. It would not have been the sort of, you know, sudden panacea that a lot of progressives and liberals and many of us at the Brennan Center wanted to see, but it was a step in the right direction. And Sessions said, no, we're not going to do that. He said something like, we need to use private prisons to meet, quote, the future needs of the federal correctional system. So that memo was, you know, already pretty bleak because we know private prisons are more dangerous for inmates and security guards even than federally operated prisons. If you read between the lines of that memo, it was even worse than that because his reason for doing it was he was projecting that people were going to be sent to prison under his watch. And that wasn't, you know, a side effect of his policies. That was the goal. And that's very, very sobering.
Increasing the incarceration rate seems to be the goal here.
Yes.
Well, I mean, you know, while we were all alarmed at the nomination of Sessions and, of course, the subsequent confirmation, I mean, I don't think it came as a big surprise if you were watching and listening to candidate Trump and then President Trump talk on these issues. I mean, even in his inauguration, you know, President Trump spent a bit of time talking about crime and being tough on crime, and this was really a pillar of his campaign. And so, and also, you know, the Blue Lives Matter and giving a lot of support to law enforcement. I know that you guys recently issued a really fantastic report, which is called Criminal Justice in President Trump's First 100 Days. And first, I have to ask you, is it common to be releasing a report on the first 100 days of a presidency? It's unless like something is on fire, it just seems like a really early time to be wading right into it.
So I'll give you some inside baseball, because I think it's a funny story about how advocacy works in, you know, liberal and probably progressive leaning organizations. And to be clear, the Brennan Center is nonpartisan, but on this issue, we are against Jeff Sessions and with many of our Republican colleagues who think, you know, criminal justice is something the country should achieve. So after the inauguration, we started, you know, keeping a real tight watch on what the Department of Justice was doing. And we'd, you know, we'd trade emails back and forth during the day about, did you see this? Wow, this is very surprising. Wow, what's going to come of this? And over the course of, you know, the first couple months, the first 100 days, we started accumulating a pretty long file of everything he's done, why we think it's bad. And then about 2 weeks before the first 100 days closed, someone on our team said, you know, why don't we just write a report about this? Like, we've done, we happen to have done all the research.
Just assemble like the group chats.
Exactly. And what I found that was so surprising in writing it is, number one, it took a lot longer than I thought. And that's not just because, you know, this was a lot of work. It winds up being a long report. But it's because it's so easy to miss in the drip, drip, drip of everything that happens in D.C.
Right.
But when you actually take a step back and look at everything that's changed, wow, it's a lot.
It's a lot. Yeah. Well, this report, one, you know, the crux of it is like, you know, this incredible departure from the Obama administration's approach. And you talk like specifically about, I think, like five or six major issues that have already been like are going to be impacted by this administration. So I'd love if you could kind of take us through those.
Sure. The one that's been the most disturbing, I think. That report came out in late April, and it tried to show, you know, what's happened and what we think is next. One of our core predictions was that Sessions would start to pare back on Attorney General Holder's Smart on Crime initiative. And Smart on Crime is a sort of broad label. It covers a lot of things that the Justice Department did. But when you say it, what immediately pops to mind is this directive he gave out to all U.S. attorneys saying, you no longer are required to charge the top offense, the harshest, most easily provable offense in every criminal case. Instead, in a very limited number of cases, and he laid out very, very clear and still kind of harsh criteria about when that discretion should be used. In that narrow group of cases, and they're all drug cases, you can take into account what sentence the defendant would receive and whether you think it's fair, and if you think justice would be served by charging a lower crime and seeking a lower sentence. You know, when he announced that in 2013, Holder's initiative, you know, it was just words on a page, but we started looking at sentencing data over the last 2 years, and if you look at what happened under Holder, the federal prison population fell for the first time in decades.
Wow.
And by a lot, by around 10% by the end of President Obama's term, which is pretty,
that's quite significant. Yeah.
I believe it's around 10%. We're working on a couple of graphs to put on our website that will show that change. And the percentage of cases in which mandatory minimums were sought and applied dropped from somewhere in the 50s to somewhere in the 40s. And that's still a lot. Like, that shows you how much prosecutors are still using mandatory minimums today. Mm-hmm. But I think it's no mistake that as mandatory minimums went down, the prison population went down too. So we said, Sessions had given a speech on the floor of Congress where he called Holder's initiative a, quote, dramatic event too little appreciated. And he wasn't saying dramatic in a good way. Like, isn't this great?
Right.
He was saying this is, he framed it as an abuse of the rule of law, which is, it's just not true. If ask any prosecutor, it's a simple use of prosecutorial discretion. So we knew that Smart on Crime's days were numbered. And sure enough, in early May, he rescinded that memo and substituted a 1.5-page memo saying U.S. attorneys are always required to seek the harshest charge in every criminal case. So it's a reversion number one to the bad old days of Attorney General Ashcroft, but in keeping with a lot that we've seen of the Trump administration, when Ashcroft announced a policy change like that, and he did under his term, it was in a 5-page memo, very carefully laying out the consequences and why he was doing it, and the legal basis. Sessions undertook no such analysis. He just said, here's what we're going to do. So what I worry about is if we saw the federal prison population decline for the first time in so long under Holder's watch, probably due in large part to this directive, I think he could probably sit back and watch the prison population tick back up just because of that directive. But I know there's going to be more to come too.
He's not going to just sit back and watch it happen.
Yeah, that's unfortunately correct.
You know, when I saw that, when it was announced that he wanted to roll that back, I tweeted out, prosecutors should revolt and just not abide by this. No, but my question is, like, would federal prosecutors have any discretion, or are they bound by the Attorney General's directive on this?
They'd lose their job pretty fast.
That's probably right. So what was really interesting is we had some reporter friends that were at a briefing the night before Sessions announced that policy change. And they said that his staff was billing it as, when you read this memo, it might sound like we're saying, you know, prosecutors are sort of mechanical devices where they just determine what penalty applies and then seek it, no discretion ever. But actually, it's no such thing. Prosecutors are free to use their own judgment. And what they were basing that on, which I think is false, is a line in the memo saying prosecutors can seek approval for a lower charge from their supervisor or from main justice. So prosecutors could revolt. Many of them would be probably fired in short order. but another problem is we don't actually have any replacement U.S. attorneys. I think Trump has finally made some nominations. So maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that means, you know, deputy holdovers from the Obama administration would be pretty free in granting those waivers. But once he has his guys in office, I think it's that opportunity is going to vanish.
So my question is actually goes to something you just said a little bit earlier, and that's the idea of this. Almost, it seems like the policy goal here is to increase incarceration. But Ames, you talk about, like, you know, how in the previous administration the policy changes led to less incarceration. Look, why does one have merit, why the other doesn't have merit? I mean, is that also a legitimate policy goal to decrease incarceration?
So I think so, but only if you have a reason, like not just for its own good. But our research here at the Brennan Center has shown that while people assume there's a direct link between more people in prison, less crime, it doesn't work out anywhere near that simple. In fact, we put out a report in 2015 before I actually joined the Brennan Center called "What Caused the Crime Decline," and they used an economic analysis to parse out what caused crime to fall so swiftly between 90 and 2014 or so. And incarceration, which grew massively during the same period, turns out to have very little to do with it. What actually drove that change was improving economic conditions, which might have made a life of crime, you know, less attractive for some people, and more police on the street, number one, and police using better techniques, not just having more police on the street, but using software like CompStat programs to know where those resources are needed. So they're responding to a need that really shows up in the data. So what that leads us to believe, and we're working on more research on this point, is that our current level of incarceration is so high. You know, we're the number one incarcerator in the world with very few exceptions. The shocking stat that you'll hear a lot, candidate Hillary Clinton cited it, is that we have 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisoners. That's still true today. It's around 4.5% and 22%. But our intuition from this research is that there would be a way to safely decrease the prison population, get more people back in their communities, you know, working and being productive members of society without seeing a corresponding increase in crime rates. And there are a number of states that have done that very thing, many, to be fair, under leadership of Republican governors, like my home state of Georgia. So when we say, you know, we should be trying to decrease the prison population, it's not just for its own good, though there's a lot of good that can be done from that, but it's because we know that it won't jeopardize and may actually improve public safety along the way.
Yeah, if every other country can do it, it's hard to see why the U.S. Should be accepted to that rule.
Right.
And of course, one of the continuing ironies of it is that this whole Sessions-led crackdown is based on this whole American carnage idea, which is just untrue. There is no...
Exactly. So we have another track of work where we track crime rates in big cities and try to explain, you know, where they're going up and why. And if you listen to Trump's speech at the Republican National Convention, he said, decades of progress in public safety are being reversed by the Obama administration. And he was fond of saying that the murder rate was the highest it's been in 47 years. both of which are demonstrably false. if you look at the national crime rates, it's a straight line down between 1990 and 2015. That's not the sort of thing you could reverse overnight, even if you wanted to. And if you look in many big cities, and New York's one of them, the rate or the graph of crime over time looks almost parabolic in how quickly it shoots down. There are some cities, and Chicago's the one that stands out in our research, where crime is up, and there's no hiding that. But Baltimore too, yeah.
What's going on? Do you have a sense of like what's going on there? Why are Baltimore and Chicago the outliers?
So there are a couple of theories. The problem here is that it's so hard to get good, reliable data to explain changes over the past 2 years. Like if you want data points to throw into, you know, any type of good analysis, you're going to wind up with like two, like crime what it was last year and crime what it was today. Mm. And you can go, you know, month by month, but it's still difficult. We have a couple ideas. Just these are both cities that are extremely poor, have had problems with poverty for decades and decades and decades. They're also cities that never really saw the type of decrease in crime the rest of the country did. The Chicago murder rate is still like at least triple the national average. The Baltimore murder rate is even above that. And they never really saw the same sort of rapid decrease that cities like New York did. So one theory is that these are cities that were already having a really tough time with crime. And then it means that any immediate crisis, any big problem the city faces, it might not be able to handle as well. So that's one theory, but there's a lot more analysis that could be done there.
Do you think it has anything to do with policing dynamics in these cities?
I do personally. So if you listen to conservative commentators, they'll say, and even former FBI director James Comey, you'll hear them say that police aren't respected anymore, no one trusts police anymore, and that's causing crime rates to skyrocket. And Sessions has said this too. He said something like, all these criticism of police that officers are hearing makes them less willing to do their job, and they're not out on the streets preventing crime. I think that's an oversimplification, number one, and it doesn't really have any data to back it up. And to be fair, my alternative explanation doesn't have any data to back it up either. but it's just anecdotes. But if you talk to police officers, most of them will reject that explanation out of hand. There's Charlie Beck, the chief of the LAPD, I think it is, wrote an op-ed last year saying, if these people are saying that my officers aren't doing their jobs, they're flat out wrong. They are doing their jobs, but they're having a really hard time winning over the trust of their communities lately. And, you know, why might that be? I mean, you look no further than Chicago and Baltimore to see why. These both cities have seen highly public instances of young black men being killed at the hands of law enforcement for no real reason. It wouldn't surprise me if, you know, community members see that. They say, I don't know if I can trust the police anymore. They're less willing to report crimes, so police aren't able to do their jobs, and it just builds a vicious circle of declining trust and increasing crime. The way to break that would be some of the police oversight that we've seen the Justice Department, unfortunately, retreat from. You know, work by well-intentioned prosecutors, well-intentioned, you know, law enforcement experts to find ways to get officers interacting with their communities, having them seen as, you know, members of that community, like a normal beat cop rather than an officer that no one has ever seen coming from an organization you don't trust, who you're not willing to speak to. So this falls in the general umbrella of community policing, but that's one thing I think personally, and we definitely do more research on it, that could help to start decreasing crime in those cities.
Yeah, Comey testified that the one time he had a private conversation with Obama, like a one-on-one, other than the time that Obama stopped in to say, hey, goodbye, best of luck to you, best of luck to you, was when he and Comey discussed sort of race and policing.
Really?
Yeah, and I wish he had a memo of that conversation, because I'd love to hear what they talked about.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I had missed that little detail. You know, we're learning so much about the way these people interact that we were happy almost to know nothing about before, trusting that the government was working fine on its own.
The norms are working. Who cares what they are?
Right.
And the sad thing is, like, Sessions, it's not ignorance explains behavior. It's not like a lack of knowledge or just total apathy. It's that he knows the rules, knows how to break them, and is effective at doing it.
I think that's right. So right after the election, a lot of us here were saying, you know, on our own time, this is not a Brennan Center position, but that it might turn out okay as long as he doesn't pick Sessions for Attorney General.
Wow.
But it really might have. I mean,
yeah.
This is not a popular position. This is not sort of, I mean, pretty much anyone else he might have picked would have been bad in a lot of ways, but they wouldn't have been this. They don't want this by and large.
Yeah. So it's funny. There was a major bipartisan push last year for sentencing reform. There's a bill that was, it was decent. It would have been the first major sentencing reform bill in quite a while, aside from the Fair Sentencing Act. And it was supported by Republicans and Democrats. Chuck Grassley, Mike Lee, legislators who don't really come to mind as, you know, liberals, very mainstream conservatives with very strong beliefs. And they were supporting that bill. And in fact, most of the party was. Even Paul Ryan gave a statement saying criminal justice reform is one of the few things I think Washington can get done these days. This was all pre-Trump. There were very, very few holdouts from that position. You can count them sort of on one hand. It was Tom Cotton, a guy whose name I'm forgetting, has been second, and the third was Jeff Sessions. Mm. So the bench of Republicans who don't believe in criminal justice reform, believe in increasing incarceration instead, it's pretty thin. It just happens to be that Trump picked one of those very few people to be his attorney general.
Well, so, you know, here's a little fun fact. I actually applied for a position at the Brennan Center. Around the time my fellowship with the New America Foundation was wrapping up a few years ago. And I applied and I actually made the short list. It was down to three candidates with your fantastic colleague, Faiza Patel, in the National Security and Liberty Department. Yeah, great work they do. And, you know, that's so, you know, one thing I wanted to call to the attention of our listeners is that is kind of the intersectionality of all these issues, because you guys don't just look at criminal justice, you're looking at immigration, you're looking at national security. You're looking at civil liberties. So could you, and you talk about, you know, how immigration also is one of the policy issues that's going to be used to kind of roll back, like, you know, that's going to be rolled back from the previous administration. I want to ask you a little bit about that and the intersection of immigration and criminal justice. But I also, after that, want to ask you, you know, during Obama's administration, plenty of people working in immigration reform were also very outraged at his deportation numbers. And if you could talk about that a bit too, and what the distinction is, what the people say. Well, you know, Trump's just kind of doing what Obama did, and that's maybe not exactly true.
Right. So I got to give you one word of advice too. I only got this job my third time applying for the.
I don't feel so bad then.
Right.
If I made the final round of my first try, I'll try again.
I strongly recommend. And right. Faiza is fantastic. They've been doing a lot of good work these days. Yeah. But yeah, it's more and more. These are sort of issues we didn't expect to be as controversial as they were. Like the before, and this is still true to a large extent. You know, we do a lot of work in our criminal justice reform project with. Allies that people on the progressive side might see as unexpected or non-traditional, like the Koch Industries, the American Enterprise Institute. There's a Koch vice president named Mark Holden, who I've seen him speak a few times, and he's said, you know, from his perspective, the current prison system is just another failed big government program. Just a great line.
That's a great way to frame it, actually.
I mean, it's expensive and bad for business. Why would you want to have it?
Exactly. That's how most Republicans, aside from the current president, approach it. So these are issues we thought would be, you know, consensus points, and they're turning out to be less so, but hopefully increasingly in the future. And two, on immigration, it's no secret that President Obama wasn't, you know, the best on this. There are a lot of things he did that were disappointing in some ways. I think he oversaw by the end of his term the most deportations ever. Is that right?
That is correct.
Immigration law is actually fairly haphazard, even at the best of times. You'd think that, you know, there are these people in D.C. that are running this program, and they know who the most dangerous people are, and they're going after, you know, the most dangerous among the undocumented population, you know, people with felony convictions, people with violent convictions, et cetera. That's not actually how it works. When I was in ADA, we saw immigration come calling about people with, you know, relatively minor criminal records. There's a case of a gentleman who'd committed a drunk driving offense 20 years ago and completely turned his life around since then. And notwithstanding that, ICE came knocking 20 years later and said, we'd like to deport this guy. I think we were eventually able to cut a deal that avoided that, which is great. But the immigration system doesn't work as a public safety arm as well as people think it does. And I think we're going to see that continue and get worse under President Trump. And I think that's what makes him so different from President Obama. You know, just a couple days ago, the current ICE director said, even if you don't have a criminal record, if you're undocumented, we're coming for you. That's shocking. These are not the types of people that you think of when you try to think of priorities for federal immigration enforcement. It shows that they're going after it, not out of a concern for public safety, but out of some separate concern. Like, they just think this is the way
what could that be?
What could that be?
I'm not going to say it, but
you know, I practiced immigration law for 12 years, and I've always said to folks, you know, one of the most dangerous thing about this field of practice is like the incredible amount of discretion that the folks who the arbitrators have in making these decisions. And like you said, you can have, because the way the law is set up, that you know, if you have an immigrant here who's been here for a long time, decades and decades, if they committed some kind of offense in the first 5 years of entering this country, that's what comes back to haunt them, not something that happens later. And there's a lot of these arbitrary kind of things, but then it'll come down to whether or not they're charged, what they're charged with, if they're caught again. And it is hairy. It is a really hairy field of practice.
I remember seeing a case that said, you know, that one of the categories that can make someone deportable is if they've committed an aggravated felony, but there are actually some misdemeanors that count as an aggravated felony under federal law.
Oh, yeah. Crimes of moral turpitude. I mean, you know,
right.
That as archaic as that sounds. It is as archaic as it sounds, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Steal a candy bar. That's it. Yeah.
Like an assault, aggravated assault, that would get you deported. But apparently, if you're a citizen, it can make you a congressman.
There's that, too.
So, Ames, after looking at this for the past, 7 months now, what do you think Sessions' goal actually is? Like, trying to figure out, I mean, obviously, there's a lot going on with him and his Make America Great Again, his sign on to that. Seems to be motivated by other things, but what's he trying to do? Like, what does he actually think he's doing here?
I think it's likely that he thinks that America really is at some crime tipping point, and the numbers just don't back that up. But I think he's looking at, you know, it's true that the murder rate went up nationally last in 2015, and it probably will in 2016 too. But if you look at where we are compared to recent history. That's not a crime wave. That's some of it might be year-to-year fluctuations. Some of it might be, you know, a true increase, but taking us nowhere near back to where we were, you know, 25 years ago. So I think you and I look at that and we say, you know, let's find out what's going on there. Doesn't seem to be time to overreact, but it probably calls for some response. Sessions sees it and says, you know, this is a crisis point. We have to do something. Throwing more people in prison is something, ergo, let's do it. I think he thinks he's coming at it from a public safety perspective, but he's stuck in a mindset that most of the rest of the country has, you know, moved past, Republicans, Democrats alike, years and years and years ago. Go back to 1984, and it was President Bill Clinton who signed the 1984 crime bill that helped states build prisons. In the 1990s, there was a feeling that the way to combat crime was to build more prisons, to send more people to prison. And President Bill Clinton shared in that view. Hillary Clinton shared that view, too, at the time. She gave speeches that supported the 1984 crime bill. But fast forward 20 years, and those same people who were involved in it will now say, you know, this was a horrible mistake. I didn't realize what it would do to communities of color. I didn't realize how much it would expand the prison population. I didn't realize how little it would do to actually combat crime. And most Republicans now share that consensus. Sessions, Tom Cotton, other Republicans like that just haven't caught up with, you know, how much things have changed in that time.
And it seems, too, that Sessions just has, like, a personal dislike of drug users. Like, it's weird. It seems like a moral... It's like he thinks drug use is, I don't know, equivalent to murder almost.
It's very strange. So if you talk to most people who work in criminal justice reform, who believe in the issue, they'll say, you know, low-level drug offenses is the area where we can make the most difference by rethinking, you know, what cases and how rarely those people actually need to go to prison. And Holder Smart on Crime Initiative focused a lot on lower-level drug users. It mostly looked at people who had committed, you know, very, very minor drug possession offenses, very, very minor drug trafficking offenses, and gave some leeway there. Sessions doesn't agree. You know, he's told Congress people don't smoke marijuana. Rosenstein testified last week saying, in the view of the federal government, marijuana is a dangerous and illegal drug. They don't really seem to appreciate any distinction between, you know, categories of drugs, severity level of drug use. It's just all bad and all worthy of, you know, the most extreme reaction from law enforcement.
Yeah, and of course, there, when he was considered too racist to become a judge, federal judge. One of the issues that came up was apparently he'd said he liked the KKK until he found out they smoked marijuana.
Right. I actually, but I read that whole transcript.
I had
apparently
missed that.
He was joking, but if you think that's a joke, that kind of tells a lot about where you're coming from.
It does, and there were a couple other, you know.
Susan, are you
like
saying
that
he's an old school racist? Is that what you're trying to say?
He's an old school racist?
No, not at all.
Not at all.
Look, there's a reason the only thing Alabama's good for is to make Georgia look good.
Spoken like an Atlanta name.
Ouch, ouch, ouch.
Yeah, so did you guys catch the Sessions hearing earlier this week?
My entire team was watching it on headphones while doing other work, yes.
Yeah, Robbie, did you see it?
You know what? I was in and out. I had a bunch of other things going on that day. The appeal hearing happened the day of Comey's testimony. Something else was going on that day, so I was unable. I think I had baby doctor's appointments, but I have like read all about like the analysis and stuff. It didn't look good for Sessions, and I've seen some clips. I didn't think it was a good look. I feel like he's dug himself in a little bit deeper.
He has some memory problems, it seems. Like, you kind of want an attorney general that, you know, has a bit better recall.
Well, many questions that he just outright refused to answer. And I wasn't sure if he's executive privilege or what, like, how is this working right now?
This preemptive executive privilege that he's not invoking, but, like, maybe Trump will want to, so he's not going to talk now. You can't do that. That's just, like, contempt.
I thought that was fascinating. So he cited a couple memos afterwards. Saying under the Reagan administration, some government officials were ordered to ask congressional inquirers to hold the request in abeyance so we can make sure that we're not going to assert an executive privilege claim. It seems like this is a thin reed to stake so public a hearing as Sessions' appearance in that hearing on. But I think that must be what he has in mind, but I don't know if that's the way it works.
Yeah, he was just trying to avoid answering and spent a lot of time trying to run the clock out. And of course, Kamala Harris got interrupted.
Kamala Harris, yeah. Also the case, though? I mean, like, because he did respond to some questions that could have been protected by executive privilege. And my understanding of this kind of privilege, just like attorney-client privilege, is once you answer some of them, like, you've kind of like waived the entire privilege, right? Isn't that how it works?
This is an executive privilege to answer whatever you want to and not answer whatever you don't.
That's a really good point. You know, I was looking back over what he asserted privilege on or what he said, you know, let me check with my boss on. And it was sort of a wide array of topics. But I wonder if any of the comments he's made elsewhere, you know, be it in that hearing or otherwise, would operate as a form of waiver.
I guess we'll find out.
And of course, I mean, the whole tension right now is the fact that, I mean, the Russia thing, obviously. But when he testified that he never even really, as attorney general, never talked about the Russia investigation or like had any curiosity to it. I mean, yes, you're accused, so you shouldn't be involved in it. At the same time, as an ongoing like not in terms of Trump, but in terms of like in general forward-looking issues, you've never looked into what happened with the Russia hacking?
Right. know, I've applied for federal jobs before. I've looked at the security clearance form. They seem to be pretty serious and not messing around when they say, you know, don't omit, you know, one single thing that is asked about here. Like, if I had forgotten to acknowledge, you know, a meeting with the Russian ambassador, I think it would have been a lot of trouble.
Yeah, and for some reason, they didn't actually question him too much on the substance of those conversations. I mean, he probably wouldn't have answered anyway, but I really wanted to hear, and I guess he just said, I don't remember, and you can't really go much farther with that, because that's what the point. But why did he meet with the ambassador the day after meeting with the Ukrainian ambassador? What did they talk about? And he did have one line where he mentioned, though the president and I have discussed how tragic it is we don't have better relations with Russia, which I thought was telling.
And I mean, a lot of his testimony was also about Comey, right, and obstruction issues. My understanding is that he testified that he kind of never thought it was weird to be asked to leave the room by the president when he wanted to speak to Comey, and that he also didn't flinch when Comey said, please don't leave me alone with the president anymore. Like, these just were not concerns to him at all.
Comey's a total pro. He could handle it. It's not a big deal. Also, he was an FD to be fired. Did you guys see the Rosenstein memo press release that came out last night?
It was very weird.
What was that about?
It was the one that said, be careful of leaks you see that refer to
anonymous
officials
sources.
Because it might not. Yeah, but it went beyond that. It said, like, they might not even be American officials. They might be officials from another country that were leaking. So the Washington Post responded by updating a story they had. Referring to administration officials to say United States administration officials.
Wow.
It seems like it wasn't a very effective deflection, if that's what it was.
This is worth reading. So Rosenstein last night issued a statement that says, Americans should exercise caution before accepting as true any stories attributed to anonymous officials, particularly when they do not identify the country, let alone the branch or agency of government, with which the alleged sources supposedly are affiliated. Americans should be skeptical about anonymous allegations. The Department of Justice has a long-established policy to neither confirm nor deny such allegations. That's not normal. I don't think that's ever... It's just bizarre.
What is this in response to?
There was an article last night about Kushner now being a target for money laundering and other financial crimes investigation. Okay. And apparently one line in the Washington Post article said, like what Ames was saying, like, officials familiar with the matter stated. And after this Rosenstein press release, they updated it to say, according to U.S. officials familiar with the matter. But this is, I mean, people were speculating it was like a cry for help. And it's almost hard to see what else could be, because this is such a strange departure from how things normally operate. Like, is this Rosenstein telling us that, like, help being forced to say obstructive things?
What's odd too is Rosenstein had kind of a reputation for being a straight shooter before this. Like, he wasn't known for being the type of guy that would be delighted to put out a statement like that. He was a very effective U.S. attorney for the District of Maryland. I know you all have more experience with Baltimore law enforcement, so perhaps there's some nuance on. But he didn't strike me as the type of guy that would be putting out statements like that.
Well, Comey called it. I mean, one of the early things that was reported was apparently he was telling friends about Rosenstein, and he was like, yeah, he's a solid attorney, but he's a survivor.
Oh, I forgot about that.
And Comey called it.
Yeah.
Are either one of you watching House of Cards this season, by the way?
No.
No.
No. You know what? I love that show. And this season has been so, like, just non-inspired because, like, real life is so much crazier than what's actually happening on the show. Although, like, they are reflecting some of the real life storylines of Trump and the administration. But I mean, like, I didn't know about what you just said about Kushner. I thought this was somehow related to, like, the tweets that Trump has been tweeting about the obstruction investigation that's apparently, like, now, you know, it's being leaked that they are or has it been confirmed? I can't remember, but
he confirmed.
Okay,
pretty much
that he is being investigated for obstruction. Okay, you know, one thing I read that Kushner was actually dispatched by Trump. I don't know at what point to go and speak to members of Congress about. I mean, this guy, like, he wears so many hats, from the Middle East to criminal justice reform. But that he was asked to go speak to members of Congress about resentencing and I think and stuff like that. So I don't know what kind of experience he brings other than the fact that his father was incarcerated, but I thought that was interesting because I'm assuming he would be a little softer on these issues than Sessions is.
Yeah, so what I think what's so odd about, or what's so interesting and strange about the way the Trump administration approaches criminal justice policy is that, you know, Sessions is an outlier even among his own party. Like, he doesn't speak for Grassley, he doesn't speak for that wing of the Republican Party. He speaks for the Sessions Cotton wing. It's actually not even clear, aside from various off-the-cuff statements Trump has made over the years, it's not clear what he even thinks about criminal justice policy or if he has an opinion about it. Like, he, in the 1990s, he said he thought drug legalization was a great idea. But then he went on to take out a full-page ad calling for the execution of the Central Park Five. Hmm.
He still thinks they're guilty.
Yes, he does.
He still thinks they should be, like, he's even acknowledged that maybe they didn't do that crime, but they still ought to be executed.
Right. It's the notion that everyone's guilty of something, which is not really a great thing to hear from the president of the United States. But it's so odd that, you know, you have Sessions on the one hand, the guy who single-handedly killed sentencing reform last year, and then you have the president who appointed him sending his son-in-law to negotiate a revival of that bill. It's very difficult to wrap your head around. We'd actually been kind of optimistic. Maybe Kushner's a close advisor. Maybe this is something you can actually move the president on. I think that remains to be seen, but I am an optimist by nature.
I don't think he cares enough to move him. Like, this is like the Javanka strategy. You're like, after something bad happens, like, oh, well, we didn't want that to happen, but we tried. We're moving on.
Don't forget to leak something saying you worked really hard on it. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's not the only instance in which we're seeing contradictions. I mean, between comments on Guther, you know, and his Secretary of State, and Trump tweeting out angry stuff about how much he hates Guther. You know, it's like he's completely kind of the messaging is very confused, and probably because you know, I remember during the campaign, it was always like, you know, can you give us like specific policy points? Can, you know, you say you're going to do all kinds of like what? And I don't think any of that's actually was ever fleshed out. They're still trying to figure it out. Susan, what do you want to close out our 5 minutes with?
Ames, anything else that you want to bring up that we haven't?
That we should keep our eye on?
Yeah. I think the next domino to fall when it comes to criminal justice policy is pot. So,
That's already fallen. Did you see where he was trying to get permission or wanting to directly prosecute like medical marijuana dispensaries?
It's the Rohrabacher Farr Amendment, right? He sent a letter saying, I hope Congress repeals this.
That sounds right. You probably know a lot more about it than I do. What was that about?
It's the amendment. It's an amendment that Congress snuck into an appropriations bill a while back and snuck into the most recent omnibus that said DOJ can't spend taxpayer money prosecuting marijuana use that's illegal under state law, which, interesting fact, that's been on the books for like a couple of years now. Under Obama, the Justice Department released a memo saying, like, we don't think this is actually binding on us. We're just going to go our own way. You know, call me if you have concerns about it. And a federal court actually said, you know, no, you actually have to play by this rule. It means you really can't. Your ability to prosecute marijuana cases really is limited. So Obama wasn't blameless in this. So let's acknowledge that and move on. But yeah, it sounds like Sessions wants that amendment outright repealed so he can have full liberty to prosecute any marijuana offense he sees fit. And that may well include marijuana use legal under state law.
Which actually takes me to a question that I had wanted to ask you and I forgot to is, you know, what is the impact on the state level of these kind of changes in federal criminal justice?
So there's been so much progress made at the state level. I keep going back to Governor Nathan Deal, who's done a lot in Georgia, Rick Perry, who's done a lot in Texas, a lot of led efforts at the state level to try to build a fairer criminal justice system, which is great. At the Brennan Center, we fear especially that only happened because you had cover from you know, all sides of the political spectrum. You had Republicans who were, you know, at worst agnostic to criminal justice reform, and many who were extremely supportive. You had an attorney general that was supportive as well. You had a president that, you know, used his bully pulpit to talk about mass incarceration. Without that sort of federal cover, I wonder if it might get harder and harder for state leaders of every party to try to push through reforms of their own. The one bright point of light there is that the same day that Trump was elected, a number of very reform-oriented DAs were sent into office in Houston and a couple other cities. So I think people are starting to wake up to the idea that, you know, the use and abuse of prosecutorial discretion is a real problem in criminal justice, but also a real lever you can use to bring about positive change.
Philadelphia's going to get a great new DA.
I know. That was fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, I know one prosecutor's discretion Trump wants to curtail.
That's right.
Let's see how that goes. Fake news, Susan. None of it ever happened. All right. So I guess we're ready to wrap up then. Thank you so much for joining us, Ames.
And yes, thank you.
And I want to ask you, is there a way that our listeners can follow you, reach out to you, contact you, or follow the work of the Brennan Center? Are you guys online?
Yeah. Please follow us at Brennan Center on Twitter. And I'm going to tell you a secret. I'm in a race with my wife to see who can have more Twitter followers. So if you could follow me at AimesCG, that would be a big help.
AimesCG.
And her, Sandy Lynn Myers.
Don't get hers. That's you're crippling yourself here.
I know. That's true. So follow me, AimesCG.
Awesome. All right. Well, hopefully you get the 45th bump from our listeners.
I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks so much again. And Susan, I'll be back with you and Sarah next week. We'll be back next week, listeners. Thanks so much. Thanks for tuning in again this week, and we really hope to keep coming to you weekly, but in order to do that, we do need your support, so please consider becoming a patron of the 45th Podcast. To do that, just go to our Patreon page. It's www.patreon.com/45thpod. Again, that's patreon.com/45thpod, and Patreon is spelled P-A-T-R-E-O-N. A big thank you, of course, to everybody who helps make this show possible, beginning with our fantastic sponsors. Thank you for supporting us. Thank you to Ray Gaines for our audio production, our kick-ass producer, Mithal Thelhan. Thank you. You are the best. We have been produced by Long Arc Digital Media. And you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Our handle is @45thpod. Please do check out our website at www.45thpod.com. And you can reach us and leave us your listener messages, which we love to check into, at 202-670-8345. Again, it's 202-670-8345. Thanks again. See you guys next week.
Did you see where he was trying to get permission or want to directly prosecute, like, medical marijuana dispensaries?
No.
Yeah.
When did that happen?
Like, recently. Past couple days, amid all the other horrors going on.
Yeah, I saw Rosenstein gave testimony saying, like, we're rethinking the Cole memo, which is the rule that... I know what you're talking about. Yeah. Sorry, that was an extremely unclean transition.
It's okay.
Don't worry. That's how we roll, usually.